This is Wednesday, March the 20th, 1974, and Peter Moran, the Assistant County Archivist, and myself, and I am Jack Coleman, are in the village of Beaton to talk to D.K. Harvey. We are at his residence at 85 Center Street. This is what, that is Main Street. This is one in a series of interviews we're doing of prominent people in our county, and D.K. has been a leader of his community for as long as I have known him. Let's begin and introduce D.K. and ask him what his full name is, because I have only known him as D.K. What is your full name, D.?
DeWitt Henry Kitson Harvey.
That's a good one, and be hard to remember, too. The name of your father and mother, D.?
My father's name was James Harvey. My mother's name was Agnes Bray.
And where were they? I should have asked you, where were you born and when were you born?
I was born in 1896, March the 29th, in the township of Tecumseh, on lot 16, concession 12.
Is this where your father was born?
No, my father was born in England, and my mother was born in Wales.
And when did he come to Canada?
Well, he came to Canada with his parents when he was a child of 2 years old. And my mother was about the same age.
Did he settle in Tecumseh when he came out?
No, my grandfather was in Melanchthon Township for a while, and then he moved down into Tecumseh. Or at least my grandfather moved down to Tecumseh and brought...
Is that the same farm that you were on, Dee?
No. My father lived on that farm for 8 years. Then he moved up to my grandfather's farm on the north half of lot 19, concession 10, and bought the farm from grandfather in 1903.
Oh, yes. And then you automatically took the farm over from your father.
Well, I lived on the farm with my father until, I might say, I went overseas. And then I came back from overseas, and my father had moved to Alliston, and he came back to the farm again, and he passed away in 1921, and he left me the farm.
What branch of the service were you with, Dee?
I was in the infantry. I was connected with the 116th Battalion.
Oh, yes. Did you have some brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had two brothers, Thomas and John. John died when he was 21 years of age. And Tom, he farmed alongside of me and died when he was age 60. I don't know the year.
Dee, you were married and have a family of your own?
Yes. I was married in 1921, and I had one son and one daughter. Donald, he lives on the farm now, and the daughter is Marjorie, is Mrs. Gordon McCracken.
Yes.
Of Rosemount.
What school did you attend, Dee?
I attended Newton Robinson School, and it was a long walk, 3 miles and a half.
Was that a one-room school?
No, it was a two-room school. They had a continuation class there at that particular time.
So you actually started then to farm about what, 1918,
19? Yes, around 19. I came back with father about 1919. And I farmed. He was very ill, and I farmed there until he passed away. Then I continued on there till 1953.
This brings up, this is an important date actually in my memory and Peter's too, and probably more so in yours, because that was the year of Hurricane Hazel, if I remember correctly. 1954, was it? Well, it was around that date. You were very active in that disaster, or at least after the disaster.
Yes, I was clerk of the township, Tecumseh, at that time, and we had the worst flood in the history of the township. And I might say that we had 400 cattle drowned. We had 5 people drowned in the township. Now that's the cattle besides the swine and sheep and so on. And we had 17 bridges washed out from that particular flood.
Did the flood affect the railway that goes through the township?
Yes, it undermined the bridge just out the north of Beaton, and the bridge wasn't repaired until the following year. And there was no trains went past there.
For 1 year after the...
Just about 1 year.
After the flood.
And then it washed a portion out at the little place called Randall, just a little bit north of Randall. It washed quite a bit of the right-of-way out there.
When we're talking about Randall, what was Randall?
Randall was just a flag station, and there was a... The caretaker of the railroad at that time stayed there, and you could get on the train at that point and go to the different...
So it was a means of transportation, of serving the people
yes.
between Cookstown and Beaton.
Right? Yes.
This was the, was this the CNR then?
The CNR, yes.
Yes. Your farm, D, being on the north, on lot 19 in the 10th, you were just on the edge of what they call the Tecumseh Swamp then.
That is right.
Now, during Hurricane Hazel, was this lake, was this all flooded, the whole area in there?
The whole area was all flooded. Even my farm was flooded. And down about a half a mile further down to the west, there was 19 feet of water.
Was all transportation stopped in the township?
Yes, it was pretty well all stopped because, you know, the bridges were out, and there was no transportation. In fact, to get out, you had to go down the 8th line to Newton Robinson, and then down around by to get to Cookstown, or down into my farm. You couldn't go out this other way because the bridges were all out.
there was a relief measure following that disaster. Can you fill us in on this, Dee?
Yes. The day after it happened, I had a gentleman come to my home, and he asked me if there was any relief over the flood, and I said yes. I didn't know him at all. He finally told me that he was from the commission in Toronto, and he said to me, there will be $1,000 in the mail for you tomorrow for you to handle the welfare. And the check came through, and I handled the welfare on the Hurricane Hazel from that time on.
Was this just for the township of Tecumseh, or was this for the whole area?
This is for the whole area, all except the Bradford Marsh. I handled all the claims in County of Simcoe except the Bradford Marsh.
Mm-hmm. Just before Peter comes in, and what claims now would you, what did you get in the way of claims?
Well, claims for livestock. We had, we got our own farms printed, and the farmers submitted their claim as, for so many head of cattle and the age and the value that they placed on them. And not only cattle, but sheep and swine. Then we had claims for land damage. We had some farms, one farm in particular, with 12 feet of white sand up in one 10-acre field, which wouldn't grow anything. We had trees washed out and washed in the fields and just left sitting there. Then we had fences. The fences were all pretty well all gone in the whole area.
This one you're speaking of wooden fences, rail fences.
Rail fences, and wire fences. The wire fences were all tangled, and the posts lifted up and washed away. So that is some of the problems that we had at that time. But you spoke about the welfare. I paid welfare as far as up as Angus, for people who had to move out of their home because the water had come up so high. And we paid them welfare, and we even paid for for the people that took them in and kept them until they get back in their own homes.
Have you got an idea, just roughly, what did it cost for your part of it? And where did the money come from?
Well, I considered the people that was awfully good to me all my life. And the Department of Agriculture, they suggest that I go on their payroll. I never submitted a bill.
I'm not asking you what they paid you. I'm asking it what the total cost of the relief was.
Well,
what did it, all these claims cost, and where did the money come to pay the claims?
Well, all the money came from the Hurricane Commission. They appointed me on the commission, and I worked with them. I couldn't tell you the exact amount that it all cost for cattle and fences and so on. Although I can tell you that the cost for repairing the fences, Mr. McClure and I estimated, and we went to the commission, and the commission asked how much it cost to put them back, and I made a guess of $13,000. And when we got it all figured up, it was $13,013.
They'll never get any closer than that, Dave.
And then on the land damage, that's for the silt that is over the land, they asked us again what it cost, and I suggested to Keith that he should make the estimate. This time he said, no, you do it. So I estimated $17,500, and it cost us $17,800.
Well,
so after that, I had no trouble, and I went to the commission and asked them for anything particular. They said, well, you investigate, and you think it's right, we'll pay. So I had no trouble with the commission from that time on. I never had any trouble, in fact, with the commission. They always worked. And I might say that Mr. McClure and I took a helicopter that was supplied by the Department of Lands and Forests and went all over the area to spot where the dead animals were. We went over the area and right as far as Angus to see if there's any cattle in brush piles and so on. And that's the first helicopter ride I ever had.
Did the local municipalities, such as Beaton, Tottenham, places like that, did they come under your jurisdiction as well, sir?
Yes, they did, but we had no claims.
Didn't? From the sort of small municipalities?
Except Tottenham's dam went out. And, of course, the dam went out and that flooded the area down here quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to go that we didn't have any claims, but we had lots in the township from that.
Did the township receive any compensation for the damage to the roads and bridges?
None whatever.
The township paid that on the straight subsidy, with the straight subsidy from the department. What was your subsidy then?
50%.
50%.
Yes.
And these bridges all had to be replaced, and your roads, no doubt, were washed out in many places, too.
Yes. And they replaced them all under the township and the subsidy of 50% from the government.
Mm-hmm. Were you park treasurer at the time, then, Dean?
Yes, I was.
But before we get on to that, there was a couple of other things. The area to the north of you, and we were speaking before we started this program this afternoon about the Nottawasaga drainage scheme, and you're telling us something about this. Could you speak to us, tell us about what that covers now, and also refer to the Tecumseh Swamp?
Well, the Nottawasaga drainage scheme is an old drainage scheme. It started in about 1896, and it went along for quite a few years. And then in 1929, a major scheme was put through to deepen the main channel and put in laterals. Now, what I mean by laterals is open ditches. And the open ditches were all considered in the one scheme. Then since that time, there's been a good many more schemes entering the same thing. The Hamill scheme.
You mean the drainage?
Drainage scheme, yes. Come in after that, the Kurzweil, and all these and the Bailey, they all come in after that, after got the main channel opened. Then they come in and
When it started, it was called the Nottawasaga Drainage. Was that just to drain the part of the Nottawasaga River that went through the township?
It was, the idea then was just to drain what we call the swamp.
Oh, the Tecumseh Swamp.
Tecumseh Swamp. That was the idea then. But then, when it drained that out to such an extent, these other drains come in that fit into the picture. And they certainly have proved to be good, because some of the best agricultural land is now in that area, without a stump nor stone on it. And that's something unusual for farmland.
It's not so very long ago, Dee, that they spoke of, or at least this area was considered for an airport. How could they ever build an airport in that particular area with so much water coming through it?
Well, I don't think you'll ever get another place that is level from one side of the township to the other. On the concession 12, there isn't a hill nor a grade. And the old landing field in the First World War was already established there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one thing about it. We're in an area where there is very little snow as a rule. We're in a belt that from the other side of Cookstown to Barrie, they call it the snow belt, but we're south of that. And the prevailing winds would be the right way for to land. Now, so far as drainage is concerned, if an airport is put in there, it'd be very simple. All these streams, they could have been easily bridged over on the runways. For instance, some of the big runways, I'll take some down the States, you have them going right in the ocean, you might say. So this would have been simple enough if the airport had been placed here. Of course, there was nobody really wanted the airport to come here. It would mean that the whole area would be taken up with something else besides agriculture, and this is one of the best agriculture lands in the county of Simcoe.
Yes, I was just going to refer to that, particularly down in the swamp, because they say when the water recedes that you can get on the land. It drains very quickly, and you can get on that land very soon afterwards, and probably ahead of some of the people on the highland.
That is quite true. The earth is porous. As soon as the water goes down in the mainstream, it goes out through the laterals and feeds out, and the water dries, or the ground dries, and the water is...
This Tecumseh Swamp, how many acres are we talking of, Dee?
I would say 1,000 acres.
Does it still flood?
Yes, it floods every year.
And how long does it last?
About 3 or 4 days.
Wouldn't it have flooded over the runways of the proposed airport?
No, I don't think so, because the airport would be to the west of that.
To the west of the swamp.
Have you anything more on that, Pete?
No.
Well, Dee, let us, we spent considerable time, although we did want all the information you had on this, on Hurricane Hazel and on this drainage scheme in Tecumseh. One thing you did tell us before we went on to tape here, probably you could just repeat it, about how the water all comes into the township of Tecumseh, which is very interesting. I never realized it before until you mentioned it today.
Well, the township of Tecumseh, the basin, which we call what used to be called the swamp, the water comes in from every direction. The creek comes down through from Cookstown up in Essa, enters down into this same area. Then we have the Innisfil Creek that starts up in Church Hill and comes down and feeds into the same area. Then we have one going through Newton Robinson, and the Pembroke Creek runs down, comes out of Agela, or out of West Wilmbury, and runs down the same area. That's on the east side. Then on the west side, we have what we call the Beaton Creek, that we used to call the Hamel. It feeds down into the same area. Then we call the Bailey Creek, comes way out of Agilo, and it comes down and feeds in and joins in at another stream and goes into the same area. Then the Nottawasaga, it runs right through Tecumseh, through Agilo, and up into Mona, up almost to Orangeville. And it comes down, and of course then there's tributaries of that, the Sheldon Creek. It comes down and runs into the same area, and all the water feeds out through at Nicholson, at the Nicholson Dam.
All on the Nottawasaga River.
All on the... In other words, we call this the headwaters of the Nottawasaga River.
Well, from there, probably we could go on to conservation here. Before we talk to you about your purity, because you're talking of the Nottawasaga River. You've been very active in the Nottawasaga Conservation Authority ever since its beginning, I believe.
Not quite that long.
Well, in any case, you are very much in the picture, and you've been you're a past president, I believe, and you're also chairman of a committee now. Can you tell us why it was started, what good it does, what you're doing now, and fill us in on the Nottawasaga conservation end of it?
Yes, I can tell you a few things, but I want to correct you. I haven't been a past president, but I'm on the executive committee at the present time. Now, the NVCA was formed in 1960.
What's the proper name of it?
Nottawasaga Valley Conservation Authority. It was formed in 1960. And in 1973, we built a new office at Angus. Before that time, we had rented offices from Township of Sunnydale and so on. And the first president of the Conservation Authority was Cameron Downey.
Carmen Downey.
And since that time, we've had Dick McQueen, Lloyd Pridham, Eugene Smith, Alan McLean, and our present president is Lloyd Armstrong. Now, you ask about what the Conservation Authority is.
Why was it formed?
Well, it was formed to protect this whole area, and this area is a big area. It is 1,210 square miles. And takes in all the Nottawasaga and its tributaries and the Pretty River at Collingwood. Now, the Conservation Authority was to protect...
Just pardon me, Dee, how many municipalities are involved?
There's 28 municipalities. And the whole scheme of conservation work is to conserve what we've got. Conserve the streams. Conserve the natural...
Environment
of the whole area. Now, there's so many things that can enter into a picture here, and part of our work is to see that there is no pollution going into these streams, and also, if there's any erosion on the banks of the streams, then it's up to the Nottawasaga Valley Conservation to attempt to get that corrected. Now, we have 8 areas, and the people have been so kind. Mr. Crothers donated one area.
Excuse me, sir, do you mean areas that the Nottawasaga Authority owns?
Yes.
Yes.
This is pieces of land or...
Yes. Mr. Crothers donated I think it was about 80 acres of land with a house.
Whereabouts is that?
It's at Avening. Also, he left in his will $7,000 to help to maintain that. That's one of the areas. And then we have Utopia, which we more or less purchased. And there was an old mill there, belonged to Mr. Bell. Hurricane Hazel washed the dam away. And it went into, well, it was used for a few years by a diesel engine after that. But since that time, the Conservation Authority has taken it over.
What you're saying, it was a water power mill.
Yes, yes, water power. We rebuilt the dam. And we have a pond there. It's pretty good size. And we have camping, we have swimming, we have almost anything that you like for the public to use. And it's got to be quite popular. Then we have the Tottenham Conservation Authority, which is another big one. The dam went out in Hurricane Hazel. the village, along with the assistance of the neighboring townships and so on, rebuilt it. But the Conservation Authority bought it and took it over. And the pond is used daily, all through the summer. We have people from the city of even Toronto and Hamilton and Guelph and so on come up there and spend their recreation in that area. We have day camps, and that is the service to the public. Now, that's what I was trying to come at. You asked what the Conservation Authority is doing. We give a service to the public to entertain themselves and for recreation purposes.
And you also preserve the area.
And we also preserve the area. And we spend a certain amount of money every year to keep that area in very good condition. In fact, improve it as it goes along.
Just there, what do you do? I mean, do you clean out the river? Do you clean out the streams? Or what sort of work do you do?
Well, we clean out the stream and we landscape it. We plant trees, and I think we planted about 37,000 trees last year on the different areas. And we put picnic tables, and we have pavilions. We have almost everything you'd need in a recreational area, such as toilets, and mostly under pressure. And that all goes in as a package deal to make the conservation area acceptable to the public.
Do you have any areas that are sort of set aside and unimproved in the sense that they're left more in their natural state?
Yes, we have. We've got the Osprey Wetlands, we call it. That's up just the other side. It's partly in another conservation authority, Osprey Wetlands. And we have a certain amount in there, too. And that is for natural habitat for fowl and for animals.
Do you have any part of the Minnesing Swamp, sir?
Yes, we have. We have quite a nice little bit of land in there that we have purchased. And it doesn't cost us the authority anything so far as the purchase price is concerned. The department pays us 75% of the cost. And then the
Ministry of Natural Resources?
Yes. They pay the other 25. Now, all it cost us is just the taxes. And I might say the taxes on that last year was almost $1,000.
Of all your property?
No, just the Minnesing Swamp alone.
How many acres did you say you had in there?
4,500.
I understand you have just recently acquired Willow Depot.
Yes.
Historical site.
That was bought last year.
From the Barry Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, and I think they paid $5,000 for it. And there's about 7 acres of land there, if I remember right.
Actually, D, what I see of it then, I mean, I don't know, I know very little about the Nottawasaga Authority, but what I see of it, what I can learn from you is that you're really the protection of the watershed. This is about what it is, isn't it?
That's
you're
just
there
about
to protect that area, that whole area, to keep it a green belt and keep that the streams from being polluted and so on. Is there any authority that lets you do this?
Yes, there's a Conservation Authority Act, which outlines all the things that we can do and what things we can't do also. And it's pretty thorough, while it changes every little while. But it seems that the people are getting more conscious about conservation work, and they're demanding that these things be done. And I might say that when you spoke of the Minnesing Swamp, there's another project on hand at the present time. In fact, I guess next Wednesday, my committee is going to go out and look at the...
What is the committee?
Advisory Board.
And you're the chairman of this committee.
We're going out to look at the Caldwell Gravel Pit. Now, that is an extension of the Tiffin property, which I hadn't mentioned before. Mm-hmm. The Tiffin property, and there's a hydro line run from the Tiffin property right back to the Caldwell Pits out in number 90.
Mm-hmm.
And the hydro owns that all. And they're willing to lease that to the Conservation Authority and also spend some money to plant trees and help to beautify it.
Rehabilitate that area.
And of course, we would have to put in a pavilion. We'd have to put some gates on so we can collect fees. We'd have to probably lower the gravel pits a little bit to give them proper swimming.
Well, there's quite a depth of water there now. I know that area quite well. Every day you go past in the summer, there are people in there using that area now.
Well, they expect us to go in and handle that for them. And in fact, the hydro, that's a change in attitude in the hydro this last 3 years. They own property, and they're trying to develop it into something that the people can use.
Don't you think there are other old gravel pits in the county that could be improved in a similar manner? Conservation Authority D?
Yes, there's a good many of them.
But shouldn't there be some provision made to make sure that the people that have created these gravel pits have... The tape was finished. I was asking you about the gravel pits and whether it isn't possible to have the operators of these gravel pits assessed an extra assessment in order to pay over the years while they're operating for the fund that you have to have to rehabilitate these areas.
I'm afraid that is gone past. At the time that they were operating gravel pits, nobody considered that leaving a hole in the earth was a bad thing. So there was nothing in so far as the municipal act, so far as I'm concerned, or know, that you could assess them for that. And the picture has changed since that. I believe that now that there is a authority in the municipal act where you can stop that kind of thing.
D.I., just to get back to this authority on the conservation, is there enough authority for you to stop me from polluting if I'm an owner on living with property on the Nottawasaga River? Is there authority enough to stop me if I am polluting that river?
Yes, I think there is. I know it has been tried a few times, and I do know that there has been some fines levied. But that is one place, I think, in the Conservation Authority Act which is not strong enough. There isn't enough teeth in the act to make it really worthwhile.
Well, how far can you go, or what can you do at the present time? I mean, if you find this was happening to any of the streams that flow in, or the Nottawasaga River itself?
We'd get in touch with the department immediately, and they'd send up inspectors up to take water samples and find out if the pollution is there. The first thing you have to do is prove that there is pollution there before you can say very much. But that's what we would do. We would send word to the department that we want inspectors to come up and inspect it. And if they say it's polluted, then we'd give notice to the person who is polluting it to stop it, or there'd be action taken. And then from there on, it goes to the courts.
This is if someone is already in the process of polluting, or you think he's polluting, but can you stop any development of whatever sort that might potentially pollute something before it starts? Have you the power to prevent development along the watershed?
Yes, I think we have power. We can stop it by going to the various departments and saying, we don't want this established here. But you have to give them concrete evidence why you don't want it.
But it's going to be harmful to the environment or the area.
It's going to be harmful not only to the stream, but if you're going to pollute the other farms immediately around it, then you have a good case. Go to the Department of Agriculture and say, here we are going to have a case of probably 400 or 500 acres that's going to be spoiled on account of pollution in the air and so on.
Of course, you know, I wonder, I agree that you should have a case to make there, but on the other hand, the wrecker should have, as I use that term, should be able to make a case that he have to make a case that he won't do any wrecking or polluting. In other words, some development shouldn't have to make you prove that he will develop or will pollute. You should make him prove that he will not pollute. You see what I mean? Turn it around and put the onus on them to make a statement, not on you. Because that means more conservation authority money that's being spent.
Of course, I don't think they do that, though.
No, they don't, as it stands now.
They get
now.
Themselves established and do their polluting afterwards, and then you have a...
Mm-hmm. It's too
late.
Sir, I had another question about the authority to bring up. It's being said in some of the area newspapers that the authority is too much an authority, I guess I could put it that way, and that it lacks public representation. What do you feel about these criticisms?
I don't think there's anything secret in the Conservation Authority work. The minister sent out to each municipality in the authority, sent out, and the papers can get copies of those minutes. And there's nothing hidden. I know some people like to, some papers like to cause a disturbance and saying, well, this is a secretive organization and so on. I think their whole idea is to get somebody to write in and say, no, it's not, so as he can sell his papers.
Can I, may I, as a member of the public, go to any of the Conservation Authority meetings?
Yes.
No. May I speak at these meetings?
Yes.
And may I speak to committees if I make representation to them that I wish to speak to committees?
Yes, always. It's open to the public. Even the committee meetings are open to the public.
But a member of the public may have a voice.
Yes.
It's not enough to be allowed to listen, but he has to be able to speak.
And the press, of course, are welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yes. In other words, the chairman of each one of these committees, if there was a stranger sitting there, he would naturally ask if he wished to ask any questions or so on. They're always given that permission to speak if they wish.
Is there any central area or agency? Would a person phone the Nottawasaga Valley Conservation Authority offices and inquire when the meetings are coming up and they'd be told?
Yes.
Get them there?
Yes,
right.
Definitely.
Thank you.
There's one other thing that I'd like to mention about conservation. We have some land over in the Niagara Escarpment, which perhaps is not too familiar to some people. Niagara Escarpment has taken over that whole area right down from the southern part up as far as Collingwood as a huge park. We own 260 acres of land in that particular area. And I think they are going to take it over. And we have spent considerable money in that area, and we expect that they will pay us back. But they don't want to pay any money back. They want to get some other land. They'll buy other land and give it to the authority and take this other over to make it a solid block for the park purposes.
Is this 260 acres in Dufferin County?
In Dufferin County, in Mona Township.
That's one thing. Conservation authorities don't necessarily stay within the bounds of a county. They can go through over county bounds, wherever
of course they follow the watershed.
The watershed, yes. Right. People may not understand that and think they're just within one county, like, say, Simcoe, but it goes beyond.
Well, Dia, thanks very much for that information on the Nottawasaga Authority, Valley, or on the authority. Perhaps we should now get on to your career, and I think I would begin by asking you, I mean, why did you start into municipal politics? And to follow that through, as we know here, you were warden of the County of Simcoe in 1947, and you didn't stop then. You went, came back to your own municipality and started all over again in a similar capacity. Could you just begin and tell us the story behind it and any accomplishments you feel you made during your municipal life at a county level and at a township level?
Well, when I came back from overseas in 1919, I took up farming. And there's Mr. Barry Jebb. He was very prominent in municipal affairs. And he asked me if I would consider running for council. And I refused the first year. And in 1931, I said yes. And I was elected in 1931 to the council of Township Tecumseh. And then 4 years went by, and I had a certain amount of people think that I should step up to Deputy Reeve, which I didn't altogether agree with, but I did, and I got defeated in 1935. Mr. James Henderson beat me that year. He was Deputy Reeve for a year and a half, and he passed away. Then they suggested that I step up for Deputy Reeve, and I said, no, if I'm going back, I'll go back as a counselor. So I run for council, and I might say that Mr. Fred Hunter, who became the township clerk, started the same year, and we were elected to council, and that was the last election I had. I might say that municipal life grows on you. You're so interested, you can hardly leave it alone. Well, I went on to 1940, and then I was Deputy Reeve, and in 1944, I was Reeve.
Excuse me, sir, but you said earlier that you went on to become councillor, and that was the last election you had. How could you be Deputy Reeve and Reeve without an election?
By acclamation.
By acclamation.
Right. In 1947, I was elected warden of the county. I thought that's as far as I had any ability to go, and so I did not accept the nomination for Reeveship for another year, and Mr. Hunter became the Reeve. And at that particular time, 1947, the first district high school in the county of Simcoe was formed, and that's Allison District High School. And I happened to be the warden that signed those papers. I was very much interested in education. So when I quit municipal life in the township, they appointed me on the high school, district high school board. And when I went to the meeting, first meeting we had, they had got there a little bit earlier than I did, and they all stood up and said, we've elected you chairman of the board. That was in 1948. So I was chairman of the board of the high school, district high school of Alliston, for 4 years. And it was quite an undertaking. I had an exceptionally good board with me, and we had to take over the assets and the liabilities of the 4 different schools, and we had to go out and purchase land and build a new high school. In the 4 years, we did that. And the first high school in Alliston, District High School, was built for 650 pupils. And now the attendance of the Alliston District High School is 1,978. So that's how it has grown from that time. They've had 2 different pieces put onto it. Well, anyway, in 4 years, I was chairman. And I took Kent ill. And I wasn't too well last year, so I quit being the chairman. Then all of a sudden, our treasurer, clerk treasurer of the township council, died, Mr. W. E. King. And again, the people at the council got at me and said, you understand the work of the township, why don't you apply for clerk treasurer? And I did, and I got it. I don't know why I applied, because I had no previous experience along that line any more than I and knew some of the works of the township. Then I was clerk treasurer from that time on until 1966, and I took really ill and was in the hospital for 2 months, and I resigned. But I was, in the meantime, the township council seemed fit to set up a planning board, and I was secretary of the planning board. I'm still secretary of the planning board yet, and that is quite a long while. And so I have still a connection with the township of Tecumseh, being secretary of the planning board. And as far as the rest of my career is concerned, it's been very happy. I've been happy with the people, and the people have been good to me, and I've tried to be good to the people. What?
Mr. Harvey, you've been talking about your municipal career and your term as warden, so that you have quite a broad experience in municipal and county government. What do you think, sir, of some of the plans or prospective plans of making a region out of Simcoe, making regional government?
I don't think I'd be in favor of regional government at the present time, but I think I would be in favor of reconstructing county council.
In what way, sir?
Well, by reducing the number of seats. When you go back in history, you find that same thing happened about, what was it?
Well, it happened in 1895 and 1896 and went right through to 1906, because I remember yes. that well, Dee.
Yeah,
not that I was around then, but...
I remember something about it. And the same thing is coming up now. You probably have to have some of the municipalities put together. For instance, Tecumseh, Beaton, Tottenham, and Angela would probably be one unit. Then we'd go to, well, Alliston is it's certainly going to grow. It would have Toshoronto, and Alliston could be another unit. And go on up over the whole county until you get your the number of representatives cut down to about, I'd say, 20. I think 20 representatives of the county of Simcoe will give you a better government than 50-some members.
There was a plan to just have Reeves and no deputies. That was another plan. It would bring it down to how many, 32?
Bring it down to 33. There are 33 municipalities mm-hmm. presently in the county, and this is being considered at the present time.
That would be an interesting intermediary step before you're suggested.
But one thing, Dee, you speak of areas. You wouldn't be in favor of these local municipalities as they are now losing their identity. In
no.
other words, you wouldn't suggest that Beaton be called something else.
No, not by any means. They would have to keep their identity. And it would have to be that there'd be probably four different, if there were four municipalities in it, there would have to be four different tax bills. And for instance, the debentures in one municipality shouldn't be absorbed by another.
Yeah. You're speaking only for representation at
That's
a county
right.
level.
That's right.
So that you might have maybe two or three, probably two from each area. This is your
Could.
Idea.
Yes. Could have.
And based on population and maybe assessment.
Yes.
Have you anything else, I mean, that you think would improve county council?
Well, I don't like to say too much about county council because I think they've been doing wonderful work. But I will say this, that I think county council is getting too expensive.
The Do you mean council itself, sir, or county government?
County government. It is too expensive. But then we can't say anything about that because no matter what you do, it's too expensive, or what you buy is too expensive.
But don't you think if it was regional government, it would be more expensive?
I do.
Because?
The salaries would be greater.
That's right, but in many cases, I mean, services can be looked after at a local level much more economically than they can. I mean, when you get higher up, and as they get farther away, then the less control you have.
Well, that's been the same all down through the years. The municipality, or township, or a village, or a town, could build a bridge, and it costs them, say, $5,000. But if the county owned that bridge, it would cost them probably $8,000. And then if the province come along, it would cost $20,000. It always goes up.
Bigger isn't always better then, sir.
No.
Well, I think that the county are considering reducing membership, and possibly they'll have some plan this year to bring their membership down, and I think this would be a beginning at least. Now, Dee, one other thing we would like from you, if possible, and this is going to tap your memory again, we'd like to get prominent people from the local area that you represent, and you, of course, have been in Tecumseh all your life, Can you name some of the people that have gone on to prominence from this area?
Yes, we could start with Sir William Mulock. He was very prominent in the Dominion government. He was Postmaster General. He was born and raised at Bond Head. That's right on the edge of Tecumseh, or in the township. Sir William Osler was also well recognized through his medical profession. He was born at Bond Head in the township of Tecumseh. So there's two prominent men that will never be forgotten in history or anywhere else. Then we have on the other corner Sir Frederick Banting, which was born in Essa, but he went to the Allison School, which now is more or less a part of this whole area. And then the name Beaton runs in my mind. D.A. Jones was the man that brought the first tame bees in the North American continent. And he took the queen bees up in the Christian Isle and bred the bees there and brought them back to Beaton. And the village was called Clarksville at that time, and then it went to Tecumseh. And then they changed it to Bee Town after the D.A. Jones.
What year would that be, sir?
That would be in
approximately the 1870s.
No, just maybe then.
Well, Beatner, they're celebrating their centennial this
year. Centennial, that's right. It'd be 1870 when they changed the name. It was 1874, I believe. And then there's a lady that I'd like to mention is Kate Aiken. She was born and raised in Beaton. She was a world traveler. She was a broadcaster. And she was an all-around fine person. And I think she should be considered as one of the greats in the village of Beaton. There are others that I could mention, but those are the...
They're the most prominent.
Most prominent.
Sir, we've talked about county government and the Nottawasaga Valley Conservation Authority and everything. Now, under the general heading of social history, so do you remember the first time when the first railroad trains came through Beaton, approximately when they came through?
Well, I can't remember the first railroad train came through. It was the first train came into Beaton in 1877, that was before I was born. It came from Hamilton to Beaton and then went on to Allendale the following year. And the CPR went through by Tottenham and Allison in 1906. And that went on up through as a western train.
What effect did the railroad have on the farmers around here?
The railroad had a great effect. They could send their produce to market, livestock, and so on by the train, and there was always, every little station had a stockyard where they could ship their cattle and hogs. That's one of the benefits. And the other benefit, there wasn't so much transportation at that time, and they'd get on the passenger train and go from one village to another.
Speaking of that, sir, when did the automobiles come in prominent use in this area?
Well,
transportation.
The automobiles come in, I would say, around 1912. I think by that time, the first one that I saw was Mr. Dennis Nolan. He used to be a county councilor at one time.
And a car dealer.
And a car dealer. And I was going to school at Newton Robinson. He drove up the road with this car. And we watched it as far as we could see it, and that's the first car I ever saw in the lake.
What were the roads like?
Well, the roads were all gravel roads, narrow at that, and a little bumpy, but people were used to it.
When did you have your first automobiles?
Well, my father had the first one in 1914, and I got my first one that I owned myself in 1921.
You're speaking of roads. In those days, there were no highways. There were county roads and township roads, and that's all. Dee, I just wanted to ask you, you spoke of the two railways, the CN and CP. Did the CPR serve the same purpose as the CN?
Yes, although it is more of a through train to the west.
I know. It's the main line, and I just wondered if it did the same thing.
Yes, it did serve the people the same.
I was thinking of the livestock. Did they carry livestock on the CP?
Yes.
Did they? Mentioned the first car. Now, what about the mail delivery in those days?
Well, the mail delivery, I'm not sure of the year that it came through, but it
we're
was,
speaking about 1920. Was there a mail delivery?
I think there was about that time. That's just about the time it started.
Was there a telephone?
No, the telephone didn't come in our particular area for a few years after.
Was your telephone a Bell, or was it a municipal telephone?
It was a Beacon telephone system. The Beacon telephone system was a pretty good-sized company at that particular time.
Can you, just in half a minute or so, can you just tell us something about a municipal telephone system?
Well, a municipal telephone system is really it's a company that's formed. And then they elect their own chairman and president and so on, and they have a certain amount of workmen go around and install the phones and look after the line, and they take the revenue and they try to make the revenue pay for all their expenses. They're a company that never was considered, or at least the company that I knew anything about, was never considered to be a company to make money. It was to serve the people, more or less.
At cost.
At cost.
Mm-hmm. What about hydro? Did you have hydro in 1920?
No, the hydro didn't come to our area until about 38, I think it'd be about that area.
Mm-hmm. That's about general, with the others that we've spoken to.
What did the farmers do prior to the hydro? For farmers?
Well, they used lanterns for light.
Oh, yes. But they had no other means of power outside
no,
of
it. Only they had their engines, their internal combustion engines, mm-hmm. and so on.
But they wouldn't use those for generators or anything.
Oh, no.
There was, used to have a Delco system. Some farmers did.
It was very rare.
Very rare. One thing I meant to ask you, Dee, before we're almost to the end of our tape, when did the township of Tecumseh start to service the roads? In the grading the roads with the power grader and snow plowing. Can you give us a rough date?
Yes,
just as a record.
It was about 1940, I think, is about the time that we bought our first
grader.
First grader.
Excuse me, you asked that question every time we've interviewed someone.
Yes.
Why? What did you use for grading prior to a power grading? Grader. I've never asked this question myself.
They had horse-drawn graders.
Prior to that?
Yeah.
You mean all through the 30s? It would all be graded by horses?
And so they had some of the bigger graders that probably put 2-3 team of horses on to dig ditches and so on.
Would these horses be owned by the municipality?
No, they were owned by the farmers, and they just...
You'd hire the man and his team.
Hire the man and his team.
Would statute labor still be in effect at that time?
No, not at that time. Statue of labor had gone out quite a while before that.
That's interesting. I never sort of tweaked to that aspect. If there wasn't a power grader, what did you use? And you used horses.
Horses.
Cars in the wintertime. I mean, did you break the, or were the roads broken in the wintertime by the township, or did the neighbors break the roads?
The neighbors broke the roads and sometimes went through the fields rather than...
Wouldn't it harm any plantings there at all?
No, I don't think so. The snow is always deep enough to go.
Sir, we've questioned you about a lot of the history of the township, and you've seen quite a lot of it in your day. What would you consider the biggest single change, if you had to pick one thing that you've seen as the biggest single change in your time in Tecumseh?
Well, there's so many changes. There's one that stands out in my mind. The increase in population. the influx of people from the city of Toronto, not only the city of Toronto, but other areas, Guelph and so on, has been very great. Until now, we have a population of about 4,750 people. And I would say 10 years ago, it was running around about 2,900. That's one of the big changes. And I find that the people are getting more conscious about the work that's going on in the township. In other words, the farming area is going to lose its identity so far as electing a council is concerned. We have professors, we have doctors, we have almost every line of business in the township to come to just as residents here and work in the city of Toronto. Now that's the big change. And it's appalling to see the amount of money that's spent here on homes. It's nothing to get an application for a building permit for a home worth $40,000, $50,000, even $60,000. And they're building them that size.
I guess we have come to the end of our discussion and talk here this afternoon. It's been very enjoyable, and I would like to express my